and welcome everybody to the EV Cafe Takeaway, a podcast focused on the electric and zero emission future we all hope for. I'm Paul Kirby, and I will be joined by various members of the EV Cafe crew each session. And this week I've got JC, John Curtis. Welcome, John.
Hello, darlings. Can't wait for tonight. Really excited. Sorry, I could be really childish tonight, so bear with.
Well, there's nothing new there. And each week we have the amazing privilege of talking to some of the wonderful pioneers, innovators and collaborators of our industry. And today we are truly blessed with actually what I would call a real pioneer, even more than that, an adventurer. Who knew that the electric vehicle industry had adventurers? We've got our own very own Chris Ramsey, everybody.
Hello. Yay. I didn't even know the industry had adventurers, so there you go. But yeah, no, it's great to be here, guys. I'm really excited to get talking to you.
Ah, jeepers, we are so excited. I mean, look, we know about this pole-to-pole thing, and that, yes, we will talk about that. But Chris Ramsey, how on earth did this... Who's the little boy that sort of started fiddling around in the shed and then off up to the hills and doing different things all over the place? I mean, where did all this madness begin?
Honestly, it didn't begin as a child. I mean, I guess from my perspective, growing up, I'm a forces lad. I'm an ex-forces child. So I guess I spent a lot of my youth traveling around in Germany and various other parts of the world. So I was very fortunate. I had such a great life. And like growing up on army camps, for people who don't know, it's such a great life. I mean, keys are left in the front door, doors are wide open, kids just go off and play. It's just, you know, you had such a wonderful time. And when I was young, I mean, about 86, I was fortunate to be in Berlin for 4 years. So to be in a country like Berlin, when the wall was still up and it was the army camps, such an incredible place to experience. And as a child, you're totally oblivious to the fact there's a wall and what it all means and that, but you love it. And then when the wall comes down, literally a year after you leave, things start to make a little bit more sense. You were there and it's how historic it is. So I think I always used to say, I don't know where the adventure in me come from. It just happened. But I guess maybe as a kid, we spent most of our hours of our day out playing and just climbing trees and having fun on the army camps. We had that freedom, and the parents are shouting on the balcony for us to get in. So maybe that's all kind of come from there. But it kind of lied dormant until I met my wife, until I met Julie. And because I'd never really traveled, I didn't really have many holidays. I kind of just worked and worked and worked from the age of like 15, 16. I was just working religiously. And then met Julie, and she turned around and said, I want to travel the world. I want to go backpacking. I want to go travel the world. I want to go to Australia for a year. And I said, look, I'm in. Let's do it. And that was it. We went traveling around the world for about a year and a half. And I was hooked. I just loved it because, you know, the amount of amazing people and cultures and the world that you see, that kind of got me hooked. And me and Julie just spent a lot of our time then traveling the world.
That, I mean, it's fascinating already. And who knew that your wife got you in this much trouble?
They do, you know.
It's true, they do. But because, I mean, later on, I was going to say, how on earth did you manage to convince Julie to come with you from the North Pole to the South Pole? But it sounds like that might have been the other way around.
Yeah, no, it's... The thing is, it doesn't take a lot of convincing. I think the worst thing is all the planning and the preparation and all the hard work that goes into behind the scenes that nobody sees. So that takes a bit of convincing. But when you're actually on the expeditions or you're doing it like we did the Mongol Rally together, that itself, when you're there, there are horrible moments. There are tiresome moments. You sometimes, as much as I love doing what I'm doing, sometimes you don't want to do what you're doing and you need to push through it. But then having Julie beside me and vice versa, we have such a great companionship. We love being in each other's pockets, and to have that support with each other, I think is quite unique. It's quite unique for us and our relationship side, but we're quite unique in the industry. I mean, it's weird that I talk about the industry as like as adventurers. We're adventurers. It's weird to talk about that, but I don't think there's many husband and wife adventurer couples out there, especially not doing what we're doing anyway, being cooped up in a car 24/7.
But that, I mean, that's where I was going to go with that. I mean, it's super like in your pocket, as you put it. I think that's a great way, and you just have to be a certain way. How did you and Julie meet? What I mean, because it clearly was before the days of the internet or Tinder or whatever it might be.
Thanks, bro. I looked that old.
I'm sure it wasn't. Well, you said 1986, so no. I'm just making assumptions, you know. Anyway, but yes. So how on earth did you and Julie meet?
We worked together. She was I worked in PC World. She was a local. She was the weekend rep, and we got chatting. We'd known each other for about a year and a half, 2 years. And then just one night, we took that courage to have a chat and tell each other that we liked each other. And that was 20, what? I should know this. But it's 22 years ago now. Yeah, it's 22 years. So it's, yeah, and it's been probably the most amazing 22 years of my life because I have grown so much in that time. I mean, it's the traveling, the what she's exposed me to in terms of travel and culture and life is totally different to what I had before. I still wonder what I've exposed her to and enriched her life, but she obviously sees something. Yeah.
Oh, we all see something, Chris. Behave yourself. Now, poll to poll. For those people who've been living under a rock and don't know, can you explain what it is you're actually going to do?
So in a nutshell, we are going to drive the new Nissan Ariya, the 87 kilowatt hour e-Force edition. We are going to drive that car from a magnetic north location in the Arctic, in the Canadian Arctic, all the way through the Americas to the South Pole in Antarctica. So that's basically 27,000 kilometers, 17,000 miles. I'm starting to learn the difference between kilometers and miles now, which is good. And 14 different countries. So, and we're going to do that in 10 months.
Youch. And it sounds like, to those of us who are just trying to take that all in, you've got big lump of ice at the top, big lump of ice at the bottom, and a jolly in between. Is that how it works?
It's you can look at it that way. Thanks, John.
Is that easy?
We'll just do it. Yeah. But no, it pretty much is a big lump of ice on either end. And the Americas in the middle. I'll use a different term there, John. But no, it's very much. It's going to be just as tough in the Americas as it is in the poles. The poles are going to be unreal. They're going to be amazing experiences, but they're going to be brutally tough because at the moment, for example, the last town or last like town, village, city that we leave before we go to our Magnorth location, just a couple of days ago was experiencing minus 37. So we've got to expose the car to that. And everything that involves and the battery, et cetera. But we've got to expose ourselves to that. And as much as what people might think, we are not polar explorers. We have no experience in these climates. We have a support team with
us. Behave yourself. You come from Aberdeen. Behave.
Well, going back to my childhood, I mean, the worst I've experienced is probably about minus 10, minus 12 in Berlin. And the snow was like up to my waist. It was insane. Yeah, so I mean, in terms of that, and Antarctica is a different beast in itself. We have shifting sea ice and thin sea ice in the Arctic that is melting, and we need to get out pretty quickly, unfortunately. In terms of the Antarctica, literally, it is the windiest place on the planet, and it is absolutely brutal. So it's you know, there's different chaos there. But when you look at the Americas, looks like it's a breeze because you've got chargers in North America, Central America, but again, they're sparse. We have done everything you should not do to an electric car to affect its range. We've pretty much done it, not on purpose. And to give that perspective, I mean, we've put 39-inch tires on this car. We've increased the weight because we have put a protection plate underneath the car to protect the battery and the charge of the inverter. But it also acts as a sled in case we get stuck on the ice and we can balance the weight, we can slide it off. So it's various different things. But these kind of things and the big 39-inch wheels increase force on the motors. So these things impact the range. We're also going to have to drop the tire pressure in the Arctic and Antarctica down to around about 3 PSI. So you'll say, impacting your range, pump your tires up. No, we're deflating them. And, and we have to because we have to displace 2.5 tons worth of weight of a vehicle. And that's the reason behind it. It's that famous famous video that's going around, it's viral, about the polar bear who slides out onto the ice and displaces all his weight. Exactly the same principle. So we can drive over ice that's about 30 centimeters thick. And that is in a 2.5 ton car.
Wow. I mean, it just, it feels like something that's impossible. And just to be clear, it has never, ever been done by anything on foot, any kind of motorized vehicle. I don't even know if it's been flown, but...
pole to pole has been done, I think, by a boat. So purely by ocean. I think it was a couple of guys that did that by ocean. But in terms of a vehicle, land, it's never been done before. It's never been attempted before. And if you think, what, the combustion engine has been going, I'm going to get this wrong, somebody will pick me up on it, but 150, 180 years, whatever. I mean, and there's never been attempted that. And the first thing that came to Julie's mind was like, surely there's a reason, so why are we trying it? But it's, but from that perspective, I mean, she's totally on board with it, but she's like, she's super great because she just gives me that little kind of question every now and then to go, have you really thought about that bit or this bit or this bit? And she questions me in a way that makes me go, this is how it is. And she's like, okay.
Okay. So 17,000 miles in an electric vehicle.
Yeah.
Sounds slightly crazy, I think it's fair to say. And it just begs the question because, I mean, this is not just about that journey. Yeah. This is it's a bigger thing, right? I mean, you've talked, I know when we've talked privately around STEM and the legacy that you want to leave. But what was the trigger? Because you've traveled the world, you've done all of this. What got you to sustainability? Why did you suddenly think, actually, I want to create and send out a message, send out a legacy, prove that actually zero emission journeys are possible on this kind of crazy scale?
You guys know my story in that sense, but to give other people context, I'm honest to the bone. So I could sit here and give some glossy answer and go, yeah, well, when I was 15 years old, I came across this and sustainability, but it's not the truth. It's not the reality. I mean, and I worked in the oil and gas industry, as you guys know, that was my job growing up in Aberdeen. That's what you do. You work in the oil and gas industry. And back about 10 years ago, I discovered the 24 kilowatt hour Nissan Leaf. And I was curious, being a big petrol head. And I thought, what's this all about? So I basically borrowed one with a friend and thought, let's do a road trip. Created Plug-in Adventures to give it a name, put it on social media, and we just did a road trip around all three UK capital cities in that 24 kilowatt Leaf, 60 mile range, 60 charges in the whole country. Had an absolute nightmare, but loved it. It was great. I mean, I got it that it was basically the future of what we're going to be experiencing. I drove around the country as well, not spending a penny on fuel. It was free charging at that time. And I thought, I've got to get myself one of these free cars or free fuel cars. And that's what I did. I sold the car. I got a Leaf. And then I think what people experience, the more and more you own an electric car, the more and more you start looking into other things. And the more and more you realize a bit more about sustainability, about how much more environmentally friendly there is the production aspect of a car, of an electric car or any vehicle. But you start to realize the benefits that there are and air quality. And then you start to look at other aspects and you think, actually, we could be a little bit cleaner. We could be a little bit better. And you start to integrate that into your life. And then you look at your life and go, I'm working in an oil and gas company. I don't really feel happy about this anymore. It's not morally where I want to be. And the industry at that point took a downturn. This was late 2016, took a downturn. I took, oddly to say, the opportunity to leave my job, but I took redundancy. And I've always wanted to do the Mongol Rally. And that is that 10,000 mile drive from London to what's kind of known as Mongolia. And I'd been looking at it for a number of years and thought, I love road trips. How could I do more in electric? And I thought, this is it. I'm going to do the Mongol Rally. It's cool. So I got permission from the Mongol Rally organizers to enter. And I decided to resign, put all my redundancy money into basically buying a car, funding the rally, and basically going for it. And the rest, they say, is history.
I mean, it's a beautiful story, and it brings us fast forward to today, where you're about to tackle probably the biggest challenge, the biggest journey that man has taken in a car.
Yeah,
this is the biggest road trip, and the irony is, for half of it, you haven't got a road, which makes me think. Well, if you haven't got a road, it also means you haven't got any charge points. You know, I mean, the electric highway doesn't run through the North Pole.
Good.
How?
But yeah, no, it's kind of like I kind of think back and I've been doing a lot of reflecting over these last few weeks because things have been absolutely crazy. Where I was telling you guys earlier on, we're literally days away. I'm on customs call for the vehicle arriving in Canada, and it's kind of sitting there, kind of trying to do as much as we possibly can. 8 o'clock in the morning to 1 o'clock in the morning, every single day. But you've tried to reflect, and I reflect on what I've done today and what I've achieved, and I kind of think, everything I've done, how could I do things better? Or how could I do better on pole to pole? And what could I go and look at and learn from to make things better on pole to pole, make things better? And I'm thinking, well, there isn't a barometer. There's no barometer for what I'm away to do, because it's never been done. Mm. And everything I've done today, there's never been a barometer, because nobody does what I've been doing and what me and Julie have been doing. And it's not to kind of go, look how great we are. It's to kind of go, well, you know, we've got to learn as we go. And the next time we're doing something, we've got to set the example or set the benchmark for other people, or set the examples for other people to follow. And that's what we're doing. So it's kind of crazy. And with pole to pole coming up, I guess with me, I still don't have that excitement. I know as we'd say, I don't have that excitement yet, because we're still so deep in executing and trying to make sure everything is in place. It's a crazy time.
Yeah, Chris, you mentioned nobody done it before, and of course you're right, but they've done parts of it, and Ernest Shackleton leaps to mind, and I'm sorry to be a downer here, but you know, it could be that this is the most harebrained mad thing anybody has done, and you may not come back. Have you thought about that, you and Julie? You must have talked about it and kind of almost reconciled yourself to the fact that this is pushing the boundaries of what any human being can cope with.
Yeah, I mean, in honest, yes. Julie asked me a couple of years ago, before she kind of said, look, right, try, you know, go try and get this off the ground and go for it. It's you know, the mission for you is what it's all about, the passion and this message is just go for it, give it a go. And she says, but you do realize by us doing this, we could die. And immediately I said, yes. Mm. And it's not the fact that I kind of go, yeah, I don't care. It's not blasé. It's like, I know the risk. The biggest fear I have and the biggest concern I have is that Julie dies or one of the team die. And it's not the fact I don't respect myself. It's more, I worry about everybody else, and I'm putting them in that position. So I will be ultra careful, ultra safe. But I mean, the Recce expedition that was done last year by Arctic Trucks. So when we leave Northern Canada Edmonton, just north of there, we will be effectively the second vehicle in history to drive from the last town of Yellowknife all the way up to the Magnetic North location. No vehicle has ever done it before since Arctic Trucks last year as a recce route, and they lost one of their vehicles through the ice. So it is literally real, real risk. And there's a lot of learnings come from that. But I guess I to touch on your point earlier on, Paul, which I forgot about, is when we're up there, is how do we power ourselves as we go through those regions? Because, yeah, we're going to go up there with an electric car, but we've got to put energy in it. And one of the things we're trying to do with this is to, one, prove the feasibility of electric vehicles in the polar regions. They have their challenges with cold impacts on batteries, etc. But, you know, we're showing that they can cope in these conditions, so they can cope in everyday -4 or -10 conditions in Scotland. So from that perspective, we're showing what they can do. But the other aspect of what I'm trying to achieve and is to power ourselves in the polar regions as much from renewable energy as possible. So we have created a portable wind turbine. And essentially, I'm making it sound very posh. It is a trailer. At this point in time, it is such a prototype. It is a metal trailer that's been bespoke made with a charging device, which has come from the amazing team at Electron Garage in Glenrothes. And we've got a 5-kilowatt turbine from Rise Energy. And that we've got foldable solar, which is a way to arrive soon as well. And that is to harness as much of the renewable energy sources that we have within those regions to put the energy into the car. And to give you, because again, this barometer thing, there's nobody ever done this before. Arctic Trucks have never modified an electric vehicle before. This is their first ever electric vehicle they've touched. So for them, this is groundbreaking for them. We've been out and done some testing in Iceland and glacier drives to kind of get an indication of range, etc. But the reality is, talking kilometers, it's 500 kilometer range car is what's marketed as. At the moment, I know I can get about 260 kilometers on the road because of the big 39 inch wheels. But we don't know how much we're going to get when we're in the Arctic. It is literally, we don't know. I have a guesstimate that we will cover around 100 kilometers a day, because great distances is not an issue for us to a certain extent, because we are driving at 20, 30 kilometers an hour. We're in slow conditions because of the terrain. But I'm guesstimating we'll cover at least 100 kilometers a day. But literally, we do not know how much impact we're going to have and how much range we're going to get out of that car until we're actually physically there.
And how much time are you going to be spending each day charging? I don't know, because I know sometimes it's always daylight and always nighttime, but I presume you're in the always daylight kind of half of the year, are you?
We are in the Arctic. So basically, well, in Antarctica, it's 24/7 daylight in December. That's why it's the expedition season in Antarctica. In the Arctic, when we're up there, because of how everything has worked out and the timelines and availability of things and modifying the vehicle and building the charging equipment, is compressed our timelines. So we are now going into the Arctic in March, but we need to come out of the Arctic by at least, we need to be back into mainland and the town of Yellowknife by at least the 6th of April, because it's summer. The days are getting longer, which is great. We get access to sun. But the fact is, it's getting so hot so early that the sea ice is melting a lot sooner. And also, people might know the Ice Trucker Road, big famous TV show. We'll be driving a little bit on the stretch of that road, and that road used to close round about end of April, and each year it's been coming later earlier and earlier. So now it closes by the 6th of April, and we have to get off it by then, or else if we have issues, we're on our own.
Wow. I mean, we're focusing on the ice, and obviously I know, you know, why, because, you know, we all worry, don't we, that our range goes and everything like that, but also the incredible challenges and sort of jeopardy that you're facing and putting yourself in. But I mean, I've watched The Long Way Up, right? So I know that they had a big problem in the middle of America as well. where they there was a risk that they couldn't go through, they might get kidnapped. And I know you're no Liam Neeson, but you know, but there was a serious risk from you know, banditos in Mexico. Yeah. And then there was a certain chunk where they had to go on a boat. Now, what is happening in that sort of area as well?
It's a question that comes up quite a lot on social media, which is the stretch between South America and Central America, the Panama, and there's a stretch of land there called the Darien Gap. And that area is literally, it's a no-go for anybody. Literally no-go for anybody. Even the military, I mean, I think they were worried about going in there. So it is just one of those areas that nobody goes. So every expedition, every person takes a boat and takes their vehicle around that section. And it's
right.
It is a reality. But this is a thing that we've always find. I mean, you will always find that individual or those unscrupulous individuals in any country. We've got them here, you know, in my hometown. And you always have that everywhere. But I mean, we've traveled through Kazakhstan, through Russia, through Azerbaijan, Georgia. And we were just, when we were there, it was for us, it was kind of like, we were at the mercy of the locals to allow us to charge when we charged in the Mongol Rally. And you're throwing yourself, that vulnerability is like, if I don't get your help, you know, I'm stuck. And you're relying on this stranger you've literally just met to give you help and support. And then they're inviting you into their home and stay with me. And your brain kind of goes, this is not, maybe this shouldn't be right, but I'll just go with it. And everything always works out. Will it work out every time? Don't know. But it's when we're in South America and Central America, it's kind of like, it's going to be such an amazing cultural experience and such an overload of our emotions and senses when we're there, that throwing ourselves into that, I think we're going to find that, you know, what the media tell you, what the government and all these government things, don't go to this country because you will get mugged, you will get robbed and everything. You'll find you get so much more comfort, warmth and kindness than anything else.
Yeah, I mean, you are a massively optimistic human being, Chris. You always have been. And I applaud that hugely. But life isn't always like that, not for anybody. And there must have been times in your life when you've been sorely tested. Talk to us about a time in your life where it's almost helped to shape who you are and what you learned from a tough time.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you know this, John. I mean, one of the things that people won't know is, I mean, when I first started, I'm always blessed with the people that around me support me so much. And there's more people than just me. And there's Julie as well. And there's other people who have supported us on this journey. And you, for one, John, were there in the early days of Pole to Pole, and you supported me so much. And I can't thank you enough for that. And one of those times was like when, during pre-Mongol Rally, my mum was diagnosed with cancer, and it was a tough time. And you know, it hits any family, and my heart goes out to anybody who's been impacted or is still impacted by that. And she went through chemotherapy. She came through that other end, and she was looking quite good. And we did the Mongol Rally. Everything was happy. Everything was great. And then we were doing pole to pole, and I was pushing and working really hard to get pole to pole. I mean, to give every indication, I mean, my life was pole to pole. I was doing my day to day life, and then I was working until 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock in the morning. I don't glorify it. I don't advocate for it, but that's what you do when you want to bring your passion to life. And then to kind of get a phone call from my dad to say that my mom's in hospital and her tumors had spread to her brain. And she had two brain tumors, and we went to the hospital to see her. And literally, we're getting told, spend some time with her. You've literally got months. And my mom was totally oblivious to this. And I distinctly remember, I think I was actually on my way to meet you, John, if I be completely honest. I distinctly remember being at my parents that night before coming over to Edinburgh, and you know, my mum's, again, like I said, at this point, totally oblivious to what's going on. And she's having debates with my dad about how she wants to update, you know, carpets and all this kind of stuff. And we're sitting there thinking, you're not going to be here. as far as we knew, and it ripped me apart. I got in the car and I drove that morning, and I was literally in tears driving over to Edinburgh. It was tearing me apart at that point. And we're pleased to say that diagnosis turned out to be wrong. They were operable and it all worked out, and now she's fighting fit. But the one thing, even when my mum found out, my mum was like me. She's like, oh, well, let's get on with it. I'll fight it and risk what we do. Mm-hmm. And I guess that's, you go through a tough time, but when you've got an individual like that, that's so close to you, that has that attitude, that just rubs off. And that is, I mean, that's how I found strength, because the one person who was going through all of that was kind of going, yeah, let's just deal with it. It is what it is, right? And we deal with it and we will fight through it and we'll overcome it. And that's, I think, I guess, the biggest strength that I find. And that's where I get all this kind of this optimism from. I mean, I know there's going to be things that are going to go wrong. There's going to be things that are maybe going to stop us on this expedition, but we'll find a way. We'll find a way around it. Mm.
I'm so glad that story ended positively, because you deserve that. Your mum deserves that. And I, you know, it sounds like the spirit of your mum is in you and she's still alive, which is great news. Yeah. And that optimism, that determination to tackle life is what has dropped into Chris Ramsey. And you know, it's so interesting to see, and we get to talk to people, you know, whether it's people or an event or something that just goes plop into somebody's life and gives them the fizz that they need to tackle it. So wherever you are and whatever you're doing, I have every optimism. I now know I'm as optimistic as you are, because that's the optimism that you need, right?
Yeah, I mean,
which is fantastic.
It's you know, it's strange that you always think that the worst things in life can draw out the best in people, and it seems I am optimistic. I am an optimistic person, and I will always look on the bright side a lot of times. But there are times, don't get me wrong, where I just like, I hate it. And I'm like the guy who's very angry at times, but that's everybody. And it's the people that kind of think, look at your life, it's perfect. Or look at what you're doing. You're just happy and everything. It's not the way life works. And I think that's what I kind of say to people is like, you know, be happy, be optimistic. There is going to be rough times in life, but it's how you deal with those rough times. Sometimes you'll deal with it badly, but just try and deal with it a little bit better each time. And you know, not saying you'll always get rid of those rough times and you'll always be able to deal with them perfectly, because we're all human. We'll all make mistakes.
Chris, you said a really interesting phrase, always look on the bright side of life. Reminds me of The Life of Brian, Monty Python, but it's a song. And it brings me to a question. You're going to spend an awful lot of time with Julie in the car. Have you got a playlist of tracks for different parts of the journey? Ice Ice Baby, you know, clearly through the North Pole. And what will those songs be? Can we have a Spotify playlist?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, if Spotify are available, you know, who knows if they're listening. But no, we don't actually have a playlist. We have differing tastes in music, so to speak. I mean, I grew up as an 80s child, essentially, on Phil Collins and Genesis and Marillion and Guns N' Roses and all these things. But my secret bands are Guns N' Roses and Metallica, Red Hot Chili Peppers. That's what I really love. But it's not what Julie loves. And I can listen to anything. She can listen to certain things. So I kind of generally go with what she would like to listen to.
What things? What's Julie like?
Well, interestingly enough, she does actually like Red Hot Chili Peppers. So that's a good one. That's our kind of compromise. and other things is pretty much it's a shame, because she loves a lot of the radio. So we're now going to be having to try and find radio stations. And I guess that's going to be the fun part, right? We're going to be listening to radio stations in so many different countries.
You're going to need a really big mask. I'm telling you now, it's going to be huge.
We're talking about, I mean, one of the podcasts we've got to put on has got to be a Spanish lesson, so we can learn Spanish on the way down into Central America and South America. And that's going to be some great, hilarious conversations, I think, us two learning Spanish.
Well, Spanish or Portuguese? Which half are you going?
Well, Brazil speaks Portuguese. Oh, a part of Brazil. I've, obviously, people in Brazil are going to be
Brazil
listening.
Brazil is Portuguese.
Yes, Brazil is going to be listening to this podcast, obviously. But so I don't want to offend them.
They just won't understand any of it.
I know we're in São Paulo recently, and they spoke Portuguese. So I don't know if it's the whole of Brazil that speaks Portuguese, or if it's just that region.
The whole of Brazil, yeah, I think.
But everywhere else, is, I believe, is Spanish. So, and unfortunately, at this point, it doesn't look like we'll be in Brazil. We'll be in Chile, Argentina, Peru, Colombia, and Ecuador. So we're pretty much everywhere else other than Brazil. And it's just basically the vast distances we've got to cover across the country to get to the main city. So from that perspective, we'll stick with South American. But then again, we didn't know Kazakhstan, we didn't know Russian, we didn't know Georgian or Azerbaijan. So we managed quite well.
How do you get on without sat-nav, Chris? How is it that, presumably going across the North Pole, there's no, TomTom or sat-nav saying, at the next polar bear, turn left. So what's the scoop? How do you navigate?
Well, that's where we are not stupid. This is where we need to have the experts. So
I am.
we're working with Arctic Trucks. So Arctic Trucks, people know them because they're the guys who modified our car and made the Aria look absolutely awesome. Mm-hmm. It looks amazing. And I know people looking at pictures and going, that looks awesome, but wait till you see it in real life. I mean, hopefully we can get back to the UK with it and show people the car because it looks amazing in real life. But these guys are coming with us in the Arctic and they're going to be with us in the Antarctica because they've been running expeditions in these regions for about 30 years. So they know, I mean, things like, for example, base HQ is going to be in Iceland in a guy called Emil, who's the MD of Arctic Trucks. He's going to be sitting in his office mapping sea ice and the sea ice melt and the ridges and everything all the time and in communication with the team while we're in the Arctic, just to make sure that we don't get too close. Wow. So he will be navigating a route via the maps that he's seeing, but also the guys on the ground will be navigating via, we know we have a route mapped out, but they'll be navigating it via the ice thickness monitoring equipment that we have with us, because it may look good on the satellites, but there may be sections of it where maybe too thin ice, and that's where the ice thickness monitoring equipment comes into play. So again, open, honest, we have, and we've said this, you guys know, we have combustion engine vehicle support with us. Any expedition will have support vehicles regardless. We cannot get the permits to go into these regions without that support vehicles because nobody has the confidence or the trust, if I'm being completely honest, in electric vehicles because it's never been attempted before.
Mm. Yeah. Mm. Chris, I mean, do you think that, given the technology that's available today, like with wind turbines and the ice monitoring, the satellite being able to sort of review the ice thickness, this map and this communication, all of that sort of stuff, do you think that this could have been tackled, say, even remotely safely, 20 years ago, even with an electric vehicle that would have done it? Because we didn't have the other technology, or is it a nice kind of meeting of the minds on all fronts that is enabling this?
I think it's the latter. I mean, I think technology wise, the car, I guess if we had not had that pause in the electric revolution that we were having back from the RAV4 and everything, so there would have been a vehicle capable of it, absolutely, because it would have had a larger battery, etc. So that's fine, technology wise. Mentality wise, I don't think we do. And again, it's kind of like, because I'm fortunate that people like the guys from Arctic Trucks, they get the reason why we're doing it. And it's not just about pushing the technology and doing, people think this is maybe just a big PR stunt. It's not. It's basically what they're looking into going, we want to develop the technology so we can use these types of vehicles in polar exploration going forward, whether at the moment it's a mild hybrid, so it's a large battery, small motor, etc., but eventually develop a capable enough vehicle that's purely electric. To do that, they need somebody who that's what they know and that's what they do and has the knowledge and the expertise to basically and effectively sometimes the crazy brain, as I keep getting told, to go and give that a go and be invested into why it's happening. And I think to date, I mean, I haven't come across anybody else. And that's why I guess it's kind of like, that's why I'm doing it. We're doing it because if we don't, at the moment, it doesn't look like anybody will. And unfortunately, if they do, it will literally be a PR stunt. It won't be for any legacy reasons. So Arctic Trucks are going to look to electrify their polar expedition vehicles going forward. In South America, when we talk about, you know, charging infrastructure before, South America, I've worked with NLX, the guys who were involved in Long Way Up, to build that network further, expand on it further. So now we have an infrastructure that we can use, but electric vehicle drivers can use. We've worked with an education company, a digital newspaper for kids. We've just announced our expedition flag winner, which was so cool, Grace from Long Island.
Yeah, I saw that. It was really cool.
And so with them, we're then putting that, we're answering all the kids' questions throughout the expedition. We're putting those stories into those kids, and we're going to meet with schools to educate them about the vehicle, the technology, the impacts on in the Arctic, etc. So it's more about that. And that's, I think that's what you're alluding to before. It's more about that than the expedition. It's more about the stories and the education. Yeah. And I think it's important for people to understand, me and Julie are not going, we have all the answers, we're going to tell you what you should be doing. We're kind of going, you know what? We don't have all the answers. We have got this crazy ability to be able to, you know, to go and do these things and push boundaries. That captivates you guys. Mm. That makes you want to watch. And then while we're doing it, we can show you all these amazing things and people and cool things that are going on in the world that's helping to fight the climate crisis. There's the information. You choose what you do with it. And hopefully you'll choose more sustainable choices.
And that's what seems to be like really laudable about this whole thing. It's not just a road trip. It's not even, and I'm going to say just the Mongol Rally, because the Mongol Rally was like a rally, right?
Yeah.
This seems to be leaving a legacy. And I mean, you've just articulated that really well. And but it feels that that's the core of the reason that you're doing this.
Julie says it all the time beautifully. And she always just says, this is not about us. Absolutely not about us. Mm. It is basically a journey of discovery, a mindful journey of discovery and hope, and just showing all the amazing things that are going on in the world and just showing there's kindness and there's hope and there's inspiration in the world. It's not 100% not about us.
Mm.
Chris, how can people follow what you're doing? How can they keep in touch with you as you move north and you go to the North Pole and start the rally? How do the young people get the messages from you? How do we get the messages out and support
and the
you?
Old people? And the old people.
Exactly. I mean, I'm in.
So we've got a website set up so people can go to www.poletopoleev.com. But a lot of stuff as well we're going to be putting out across all the social platforms. But the main one that we're using quite a lot is Instagram. So that is, again, @poletopoleev. And I've also been convinced to do TikTok. So let's see how that works out.
Perfect.
And pole to pole is the number 2 or the letter 2?
The word 2. And interestingly, it's the word 2 because we thought the opposite, that people would think, people would be questioning how to spell it because they'd be thinking it was the word 2 and not the number 2. So, but it's worked completely opposite. So yeah, so that it's the word 2.
Excellent. I want to carry on talking because for me, there's the Ecuador story, right?
Yeah.
You know, I'd love to talk to Chris about the Ecuador story, which is about one of the most sustainable countries on the planet. Tell us about that.
Cool.
You're getting to do all this journey all the way down. So that it's like we're starting at the pole and we're focusing on the other pole. There's this whole great bit in the middle as well, which is so freaking awesome.
I mean, it is.
And so crazy interesting.
And I mean, the cool thing from there, I mean, we're going into from -30, -40, maybe -50, whatever, with wind chill. But then we're going into like +30, maybe +40. It's insane. So we're taking those two extremes. Then we're driving across the Andes, you know, and I single out the Andes just because it's just going to be monstrous. It's going to be an amazing drive. wondering what my regen is going to be when I go back downhill, which is going to be amazing. But and we touched about before about the stories that is, you know, the people we're going to meet. And I'm sure at the moment we've been working closely with a couple of organizations, the British consulates in North America, Canada, about some projects, some battery, some guys in who take batteries and basically recycle them, reuse them, goes into charging infrastructure, goes into homes, as we all know about that. But there's so many things. I mean, Costa Rica is, I think who you're referring to earlier on, Paul, really was Costa Rica is the most renewable energy.
Ecuador.
Yeah, it's no, but it's the most renewable energy country, pretty much. It's 99% renewable. It's never extracted any oil in its life. And it's just a phenomenal country. And I'm looking forward to learning more about that because that's pretty much all I know about it. But in Ecuador, and again, the conversation we've had, and this is probably where you've thought about Ecuador, is when we're in Ecuador, we're hoping to meet with an Amazonian tribe. And this tribe is phenomenal because wow. The tribe leader, she found the government were going to basically wipe out 7 million hectares of their land, of their Amazon forest, their indigenous tribe's land. So they all, that tribe, took the country to the Court of Human Rights, I believe it was, and stopped it. So now that 7 million hectares of Amazon forest in Ecuador is protected for life.
Wow.
It can't even be reversed. And that is just incredible. I mean, what we're doing is nothing compared to that, you know, in that sense. And it's just showing is some people know about that, some people don't. And it's just showing that so many cool things going on. And even down to in North America, I'm going to talk about this all day, but in North America, there's just communities of when I've got together, went, let's go plant some trees, let's go clean up this area, let's go and do some seagrass and let's clean our beaches. And all those things sound like, yeah, they're stereotypical. That's what people are doing to kind of greenwash or whatever. But it's not. It's those simple little acts that people can do that make a big difference.
This is what's so beautiful about this expedition is that it's just shedding light on this world of brilliance, of good news, people doing positive stuff. John?
I once had the great honour of being driven by Chris Ramsey from Bath to London. And okay. Chris, you wore what can only be described as the most fugly shoes I have ever seen. And they had individual toes.
Toes.
Yeah. Please tell me you're not going to be wearing those darn things.
No, I'm not. I'm not taking them with me. I was tempted. They're so comfy. But this is the cool thing. When we're in Antarctica and the Arctic, I know, again, we always focus on this, but in there, we've been learning all these things about simple things like, have you got the bathroom? How do we brush our teeth? What do we do with things when we're finished with it? That kind of stuff. Everything that comes in, goes in, has to come out. And we've coined the kind of phrase on this that the expedition is basically going to tread as lightly as possible and leave as little impact. So when we're in the Arctic, when we're in Antarctica, everything, I mean, I know rubbish, that's what you would do just as part of course, but I mean literally everything that comes, that goes in and comes out of us, comes back out again. So we're going into every little detail. Yes. And when it comes to things like, I've been learning about driving in the Arctic, and they're saying when you're in the Arctic, Antarctica, you really want something warm and comfy in the car when you're driving. And then when you get out, you just put your boots on and you can go and do and your thing. So I'm thinking, well, you get these nice warm slip, like kind of effectively like sleeping bags for your feet. And I thought, but I could just take my Vibram, my five finger shoes, because they're nice and comfy to drive in, but they're not very thermal. So I've decided against them.
Thank goodness we will be spared National Geographic wherever you end up on the telly, you won't be there.
But it shows the simplicity because, like, when we're in the Arctic, we're talking about how we sleep. So we're going to be, I mean, even throughout the expedition, that car, like the Mongo Rally, is our hotel. So a lot of the time we're going to be sleeping in that car. This is not a jaunt through and as a jolly, as somebody referred to it at one point.
So jolly?
It's you know, we're not sleeping in we will sleep in hotels on occasions, but at the end of the day, the vast majority of time is campsites, tents in that car. In the Arctic, we'll be sleeping in the car at times, because if the polar bears take a little bit too much of an interest or do trackers too much, we have, we, you know, maybe we sleep in the car, but in general, we'll be sleeping in the tents. And it's, that's kind of the interesting thing there. But I mean, that's been my philosophy. I've always, my brain has been like, how are we going to sleep? What's the practicalities of that? And we've got to get the car to charge. We've got to cross this. How do we cross this section of ice? And Julie's very much like, then brings my back brain back around to kind of, how do we brush our teeth? How do we go to the bathroom? What do we do with this? How does that work? You know, and it, and it's just, how do I make a drink in the Arctic? You know, where do we get the water from? Because it's all salt water. And then you start to find out all these things. And it's just, I think that's why we work so well, because our brains work completely different.
And it's a nice place to complete the chat, really, because you started out by highlighting this wonderful woman that showed you a good time in a completely different way, took you around the world, and showed you something new, encouraged you to go beyond yourself in that moment, and has supported you amazingly. So really, this isn't about Chris Ramsey. This is about Julie Ramsey. We're seeing this now.
She's the reason I'm sitting here today. Absolutely. She really is. Because she, the amount of encouragement and support she puts behind me is amazing. I mean, like I say, 4 years trying to get this off the ground, she has basically been the individual that's earning the money while I'm out here trying to make this, this happen. She's the biggest inspiration and has made me the man I am. So I cannot thank her enough.
Well, and it's funny, we often ask that that question, who's been your inspiration? But, you know, we've just heard for the last few minutes exactly who that person is. And Julie, we thank you, because Chris is also an inspiration for us as well now, as the face of this. But we thank you that you're the energy of this behind the scenes. And Chris, we could talk honestly for hours, and we do talk at different times. But I think we've given our listeners a really good snapshot. And I would encourage you to pick up on John's point, follow you guys on Instagram, on all of the various different channels that are going to be available, which we will publish somewhere, so that you can access that. And I think there is a where you can, you're raising money, right? Because of all this legacy and all the thing you want to leave behind, you're raising money to help do that. What is that?
So we have a GoFundMe page set up, and that's on our website. Again, the reality is people think that this expedition is fully financed and we've got major big people behind us. We have the graciously for support from Nissan and BF Goodrich and as well. So they are amazing, but we don't have the project fully financed. This is a plug-in adventure expedition. It's not a Nissan or a BF Goodrich expedition. It's our expedition. And the two people organizing, as you touched before, the two people organizing the biggest automotive expedition pretty much in history is literally me and Julie, and that's it. And we don't have a team of people. It is literally just us. So what we do have the GoFundMe up there, and what we've said in the GoFundMe, just so people are aware, is if we are overfunded on that GoFundMe, that money won't be going to us. There's very little money on this expedition going to us. If I'm being brutally honest, we're not really taking salaries now. From that, we are going to give that back to communities, the charities, the organizations, the schools, the projects that we meet along the way, so we can basically do good in the world. That's all we're trying to do with this. Educate, hope, inspire, and just do good in the world.
There's no better way to end. Chris Ramsey, thank you so much. You have been a font of inspiration and knowledge and insight and wisdom. We're so encouraged to have had this time with you and by de facto your wife, Julie, as well. And I mean, it goes without saying that we wish you all the best.
Thank you.
And we look forward to doing another podcast when you arrive back in the UK safe and sound. And we would love to hear how it all goes. But until then, we will be following you on your website, on your Instagram, and looking forward to seeing all of the good that will unfold and uncover in the world.
Great.
Chris Ramsey, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, guys. Thank you for inviting me on.
And if you want to get more of the EV Cafe, obviously you can check us out on our website. Please do follow us on our LinkedIn page. We will no doubt be finding and uncovering and posting things about the wonderful Chris and Judy Ramsey as they go around the world, or from north to south anyway. And until next time, have a great day, everybody.